The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page with the cover story article headline, Where Are the Women? Across the nation, including the Triangle, women continue to struggle to find a seat on corporate boards. And the article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline, Public Companies Slow to Bring Women on Board. And this article is written by Cameron Snipes. Even as the U.S. sets aside the month of March to observe National Women's History Month, and the globe collectively recognize the social, economic, and cultural impact of women on International Women's Day on March 8, there remains little movement to include more women in American corporate boardrooms. Triangle Business Journal reviewed data from roughly 3,000 public companies with market capitalization of at least $100 million and found that among those companies, male directors outnumbered their female peers by a 6-to-1 ratio at the end of 2017. There were 710 boards that reported no women directors at all, and found another 1,034 companies with just a single woman director at year's end, meaning more than half of the companies analyzed had one or fewer women directors on their boards last year. In the Triangle, the numbers reflect a similar trend. Out of 222 available board seats on the publicly traded companies that meet the $100 million valuation threshold, 28 are taken up by women, just 12.6%. Furthermore, out of the 26 companies in the Triangle in that mix, 8 have no women directors, and 12 have only one female board member. There are companies here, however, that are at the top end of the spectrum when it comes to the inclusion of women on their boards. Those include Durham-based Chimerix, which has a female CEO and a 33% female board. Following closely behind is First Bancorp in Southern Pines, with 4 female directors on its 14-member board. Red Hat, Martin Marietta, and Plygem also had strong female representation on their boards. The lack of women in top leadership positions has taken on new relevance amid recent and ever-expanding sexual harassment allegations in the workplace. In response, many women are calling for more of their voices to be heard in the places that matter. But the number of women on boards in the Triangle has been relatively static for the past 5 years, according to research by American City Business Journal's the parent company of TBJ. Even though the local public company landscape has historically fluctuated quite a bit and continues so, female board representation has been flat among long-standing publicly traded companies here, and in those new to the area or to the public markets, the story remains the same. Women, and especially women of color, are woefully underrepresented, says Hilda Pinnix Ragland, a former longtime Duke Energy Progress executive and current RTI International board member. And the issue extends to companies well beyond the scope of the ones identified in the ACBJ data. We clearly see that many organizations have much room for improvement when it comes to tapping women for board seats, from large Fortune 500 companies to smaller companies that shape the business community at a local or regional level, says Susan Keating, CEO of West Palm Beach, Florida-based Women Corporate Directors. Changing the narrative. Companies are under greater scrutiny from regulators, their customers, and a number of other stakeholders to have more women directors, Keating says. There has indeed been a fundamental shift in expectations around the board's responsibility for an oversight of corporate culture, and for many stakeholders, this means having more women in board seats as part of this oversight. So what's being done locally to stem the tide and even reverse it? Pinnix Ragland, the sole female among RTI's 15-member Board of Governors, points to 3 such entities, including the North Carolina chapters of the Women Corporate Directors and the National Association of Corporate Directors, and the hyperlocal group Onboard NC, of which she is a charter member. Onboard NC was founded about 2 years ago to promote qualified women from the Triangle area to business corporate boards and C-suites. There is a direct correlation to the C-suite, Pinnix Ragland says, of getting more women on boards, but the pool of qualified women is there. Ann Whitaker, president and CEO of NovoClem and the only female member of Cree Incorporated's 8-member board of directors, echoes that sentiment. Those who say they can't find enough qualified women for board seats aren't looking very hard, she says. Whitaker believes companies seeking board members should broaden their searches. Boards should look beyond these titles and other strict experience-related requirements, she says. They should instead assess candidates based on their track record of success as an executive or business leader, as well as their potential. Onboard NC has developed a database of about 30 or so local qualified women that have C-suite or board experience. It has a lot to do with networking, says life sciences and venture capital veteran Christy Schaefer, an Onboard NC member. We're trying to put those names out in front of the companies that who are looking to fill corporate board positions. When asked if women are being empowered in the workplace, Sally Shuping Russell, a former managing director of BlackRock and also a force behind Onboard NC, says it's a bit relative in more ways than one. Women definitely are becoming more empowered in relation to the past, she says. There's still a lot of work to do, but I think that a lot of progress has been made. Personally, I taught my daughters to be in the boardroom and not to be intimidated. Advancing the cause. Breaking into the scene of eligibility is being seen as another barrier to achieving more diverse board makeups. Schaefer, currently a general partner at Hatteras Ventures Partners, has served on nearly 10 corporate boards. She currently has a seat on 6 corporate boards, 3 of which are in the Triangle area, including G1 Therapeutics, and chairs 3 of them. I get many calls to serve on more boards, she says, but she's an anomaly in the larger pool. There's not a large number of women in the C-suite. Nationally, there are more men in the pool, so they have more chances. According to a study done by Egon Zehnder Research, 17% of CEO and CFO seats of U.S. public companies with more than $7 billion in market cap are occupied by women, and there are only about 25 female CEOs in that group. There are men advocating for more women on boards, too. Schaefer offers up life sciences veteran executive and Hatteras general partner Robert Ingram as an example. He's very involved in this cause, she says. It's very important to have diversity on boards, not just women, but minorities as well, Schaefer says. It's about having diversity of thought. Whitaker advocates for corporations to be more formalized in their succession planning efforts and to encourage directors to sponsor women to be considered for future board roles. I see European corporate boards actively doing this to ensure they achieve their required goals for board diversity, she says. I find it curious that I get more calls about taking on European-based company board roles than Triangle-based board roles. And there's also a companion cover story article written by Jeff Jeffrey. The headline, Closed Out of the Boardroom, Representation of Women Still Lags Behind Male Peers. Business leaders have long highlighted gender diversity as a top priority, particularly when it comes to populating boardrooms and the power center commonly known as the C-suite. Alas, women remain woefully underrepresented among the upper echelons of corporate America. A Business Journal's analysis of some 3,000 publicly traded companies with at least $100 million in market capitalization found the absence of women directors particularly pronounced among two classes of companies: those with relatively limited resources compared to their larger brethren, and perhaps not surprisingly, those run by male CEOs and board chairs. Among those thousands of companies, male directors outnumbered their female peers by a 6-to-1 ratio at the end of 2017. The Business Journal also identified 710 boards that reported no women directors at all and found another 1,034 companies with just a single woman director at year's end, meaning more than half of the companies analyzed had one or fewer women directors on their boards last year. In contrast, the nation's 25 largest companies by stock market value averaged one female director for every 4 male directors and posted an average of 3.2 women directors per board at the end of 2017. Pipeline problems. Women currently hold 14% of all board seats at companies with more than $100 billion in market capitalization. That percentage averages out to about 1.3 women directors for the typical 9-member board, according to the Business Journal's analysis. The analysis also found that as a company's size dwindles, so too does its likelihood of employing an above-average ratio of women directors. For example, the biggest companies in the country, those boasting a market cap of $100 billion or more, saw 23% of their board seats held by women in 2017. That ratio steadily tumbled by size category, falling to 15% for companies with between $1 billion and $50 billion in market cap, down to a low of 9% for companies in the $100 million to $500 million bracket. Celia Huber, a senior partner in McKinsey & Company's Silicon Valley office, said one reason companies struggle to hire women directors is because men grossly outnumber women in the workforce. Despite women representing 57% of college graduates, men continue to outnumber women at every level in corporate America. Huber added that men are also promoted at a much faster rate than women. It's even worse for women of color. A 2017 study conducted by McKinsey & Company and LeanIn.org found that women of color are the most underrepresented group in the corporate pipeline. Among 222 companies analyzed in the McKinsey study, women of color held just 3% of all C-suite positions versus 20% for all women. Women fall behind early in their careers and continue to lose ground with every step, with women of color facing the most dramatic obstacles, Huber said. Recruiting advantage. Experts in the field of gender diversity say large companies tend to fare better with hiring women and minorities in part because they have more money to spend. For example, top executive search firms often require a retainer of up to $100,000 and a percentage of the executive's first-year salary for a successful hire, making those services something of a luxury for smaller companies. The largesse also enables big companies to spend more on director compensation versus their smaller competitors. Corporate directors at the 100 largest companies analyzed by the business journals averaged annual compensation of $379,084 in 2017 versus $186,801 for all public companies. Companies with market caps at a lower end of the spectrum, those reporting between $100 million and $500 million in value, averaged $113,548 in compensation per director. Troubling times. The lack of women in top leadership positions has taken on new relevance amid an expanding backdrop of high-profile sexual harassment allegations in the workplace. In many of those cases, victims have repeatedly said they felt powerless to speak out earlier due to a lack of senior women leaders to turn to. But things might be changing. A recent study by global recruiting firm Spencer Stuart found that women and people of color were picked for a majority of open S&P 500 board seats for the first time in 2017, as large institutional investors have ramped up pressure on companies to improve gender and racial disparities. That pressure is likely to increase following the wave of harassment claims in recent months, said Judith von Seldeneck, founder and chairman of Philadelphia-based Diversified Search, an executive search firm. The recent focus on sexual harassment is going to do wonders to move the needle, said von Seldeneck. Inclusion at every step. What's clear is that gender diversity begets gender diversity. The Business Journal's research found that companies with a female CEO or chair average more than double the number of women directors than at companies run by their male peers. On average, 24% of directors at companies chaired by women are also women. Deborah DeHaas, Chief Inclusion Officer and National Managing Partner of Deloitte's Center for Board Effectiveness, said the number of women and minorities on board nomination committees also is steadily increasing, which should boost their representation in boardrooms going forward. As of 2016, 20% of nomination committee chairs were women, and about 10% were minority men, according to Deloitte Research. Melissa Williams, a management professor at Emory University, cautioned that companies often confuse a few high-profile appointments with diversity throughout their entire organization. It's easy to make superficial changes that don't help anyone because a token woman or minority isn't going to feel comfortable speaking out if they're the only one there, Williams said. But if the board is saying we want to embrace the advantages diversity provides at every level, it can really change the culture of a company. And now we're going to turn to the viewpoint page for the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, "For Now, It's a Lot of Talk and Tempered Action." March is National Women's Month, and appropriately, we have decided to take a deep dive into the role of women in corporate triangle. As you will read from this week's cover story, the triangle has a long way to go when it comes to giving women a seat at the board table. Next week, our feature story will revolve around the winners of our annual Women in Business Awards. But for now, let's talk about the number of women on corporate boards of publicly traded companies in the triangle. The answer? Not many. Triangle companies with more than $100 million in market capitalization frankly have dismal percentage of women on their board, 12.6%. Take out Durham's Chimerix and Southern Pine's First Bancorp, and you're staring at essentially having less than one woman for nine men on boards. With the topic of sexual harassment front and center these days, here is an opportunity for companies that want to make sure discriminatory and derogatory behavior is not an issue at their workplace. Put more women on boards and in C-level positions. It's easier said than done, and the proof is in the details. Our cover story this week reveals that among the 3,000 companies with more than $100 million in market cap nationwide, 710 of them did not have a single woman on the board, and another 1,034 had just one female board member. What does that tell us? There's just more talk and less action. Inside the mahogany walls of the 19th hole at country clubs, you could almost hear a chuckle from some members when talking about this issue. We know that many of us are saying the right things, but doing nothing in the end. But Harvey Weinstein and the scores of high-profile individuals taken to task because of their behavior are now sending shockwaves across many boardrooms. This may be the right time for some notable and respected Triangle board members, such as Robert Ingram and James Maynard, to be even more vocal about narrowing this gender gap in boardrooms. We need some big names in the Triangle to step forward and help change this dismal ratio. Women have a responsibility, too. They need to be more vocal when they believe they are being passed over for that C-level or board position. If things start getting in the open, the corporate behavior will change. If not, it only means we really are not that serious about change. More talk, no action. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Couple, woo, finally takes title to historic Raleigh home. After 2 years of navigating red tape and wading through drawn-out negotiations between government agencies, Ralph LaRosa and his wife Jocelli finally closed on a historic house along Person Street in downtown Raleigh. They finalized the deal March 9, purchasing the Cambridge House from the state for $350,000. LaRosa is already preparing for a lengthy rehabilitation process. "We're excited that it finally happened and nervous that we have a big project in front of us," he says. The lengthy process has given the couple time to reevaluate their plans for exactly how they want to restore the house originally built in 1902. At this point, they envision a space that combines offices with an art gallery. The two-story home at one time served as an office for the North Carolina Arts Council. That was before the building was relocated from its original site on P Street to make way for the Blount Street Commons housing project in 2008. The LaRosas are one of four buyers who can now begin work restoring the homes along Person Street. Another closed on the Watson House on March 13. Sales of the Worth and Gay houses are expected to be complete by the end of the month, according to the North Carolina Department of Administration. The holdup of the sales stemmed from ongoing negotiations between the city, the state, and DHIC, the operator of the neighboring Murphy School Senior Housing Complex. The complex shares an entrance and parking lot access with the historic homes. With those issues now resolved, the state was able to finalize the sale. Cary investor takes stab at political arena. Cary-based startup investor David Gardner is ready to dip his toes in North Carolina politics. Well, he's not running for office, but for the first time, he and his wife Cheryl are hosting a fundraiser at their Cary house for Gail Adcock, a Democratic member of the House of the North Carolina General Assembly. Adcock is also the chief health officer at SAS, Cary's largest employer, and one of the world's largest privately held software companies. This is the first time I've hosted an event like this for any politician, but I believe that Gayle is a much-needed voice of reason today in North Carolina, Gardner wrote in his invitation to select individuals. The invitation says former North Carolina Governor Jim Hunt will be a special guest at the event. Gardner says Adcock has taken the time to listen and understand the issues that affect the local entrepreneurs and the startup ecosystem. March Madness means it's time for the swoosh again. It's gotta be the shoes, Spike Lee once said, and the shoes you'll see the most in this year's NCAA tournament are, once again, Nikes. Nike outfitted 47 teams in the 68-team field for both jerseys and shoes, up from 40 last year and 41 the year before, according to Sports Business Daily Research. Under Armour will have more schools, 11, then Adidas, 9, for the first time. UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University have Nike deals, and NC State University has a contract with Adidas. What? A TV show on NASCAR wives? Here at Biz, we're happy to throw shade on the great state of Mecklenburg, but even we had to laugh when we heard talk about a reality TV show based on NASCAR wives. We know NASCAR ratings plummeted in 2017 and are down again, with even the 2018 Daytona 500 dropping 22% from the year before. So sure, that industry is in need of a lift, but a reality show on NASCAR wives? Really? Where is Richard Petty when you need him? Duke student gets to hang out with Nobel laureates. While other students may be gearing up for summer break, Mark Chen, an MD-PhD candidate at Duke University School of Medicine, will be prepping to meet with 43 Nobel laureates in June. That's because Chen is among 600 young scientists selected from more than 80 countries to attend the 68th Lindau Nobel Laureate meeting. The meetings have been organized since 1951. Chen's PhD thesis work is being completed with Duke's Dr. David Kirsch. The work is focused on using CRISPR gene editing technology, a hot topic in life sciences, to help answer the question of how tumors respond to radiation therapy, says Chen. The selection to attend the meeting is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, Chen says, to meet such a diverse group of both young scientists and Nobel laureates. Folwell not calling out Wells Fargo CEO despite problems. Despite California's state treasurer calling for the resignation of Wells Fargo CEO Tim Sloan, North Carolina Treasurer Dale Folwell is not following suit. Asked about California Treasurer John Chang's recent comments, Folwell said, "From a very far distance, I see Wells Fargo as an important North Carolina employer and taxpayer trying to figure out what's right, get it right, and keep it right." Folwell said that in 2017 he did accept a proxy services recommendation to vote against certain Wells Fargo board members. "We voted against three of the four who have recently resigned," he stated. While Wells Fargo is based in California, its combination with Wachovia gave it a significant corporate presence in North Carolina. Chang, according to San Francisco Business Times, called Sloan too much of a champion of the old guard to truly be the change agent that Wells Fargo so desperately needs. Now we turn to the On Technology and Startups page written by Lauren Onasorge. Area poised to land jobs from back office functions. Site selection consultant John Boyd says North Carolina could be in line to take advantage of a major economic development trend, that of major finance firms moving their backdoor office functions outside of metros such as New York City. Over the past 2 years, New York City has lost over 30,000 banking jobs to secondary markets like Charlotte and Raleigh, he says, noting that with regulatory rollback, this trend is going to accelerate astronomically. And as banking in 2018 involves heavy technology, the Triangle in particular is primed to benefit with its enviable tech talent pool. Regardless of sector, however, the Triangle is on-site selection shortlists from firms across the globe, he says. "We've never seen more projects out there than we're seeing right now," he says, noting that the common denominator he's seeing is low-cost markets, particularly in right-to-work Southeast states such as North Carolina. His firm just conducted a study that finds operating a corporate back office in the Raleigh-Durham region is 17% less expensive than in New York City, with an estimated total annual operating costs of $10.9 million for a hypothetical 30,000-square-foot, 125-employee operation in the financial services sector. The triangle is far below San Francisco and New York, which are estimated to cost $13.6 million and $13.3 million, respectively. Cryptocurrency fraud on NC's radar. With cryptocurrency schemes, the purported crimes come in several forms, from the token Nigerian Prince scam emails to full-blown Ponzi schemes, says Kevin Harrington, director of the Securities Division for the North Carolina Secretary of State's office. But unlike crimes his office has investigated for decades, these alleged bad actors are trying to capitalize on the hype of cryptocurrency. So North Carolina, along with a handful of other states, is cracking down on cryptocurrency schemes, filing multiple cease and desist orders, and scanning the web for crypto criminals. One alleged schemer was the subject of a North Carolina cease and desist order March 2, that of internet business Power Mining Pool, which claimed to own computer hardware and software mining rigs that can continuously mine 7 cryptocurrencies. It's accused of selling unregistered securities. The website depicted 2 smiling cartoon images to introduce 2 brothers, Andrew and Mike Conti, based in Central Europe, as the purported managers of PMP. They achieved great success mining some of the most profitable cryptocurrencies, the site alleged, according to the cease and desist order. But state officials, according to the order, aren't even sure whether the Contis are real people. Another order filed January 9 accuses British firm BitConnect of also selling unregistered securities. BitConnect described itself as an open-source, all-in-one Bitcoin and crypto community platform designed to provide multiple investment opportunities, but could be a Ponzi scheme, the order alleges. Those with legitimate cryptocurrency businesses applaud the regulators, says Anthony Pompliano of Raleigh-based Full Tilt Capital. The bad actors will get flushed out by the regulators, he says. Good actors want this to happen sooner rather than later. Durham's DreamWorks, fresh off new ACC deal, raises $15.3 million. Weeks after expanding its partnership with the Atlantic Coast Conference, a technology firm with Duke University football roots has raised $15.3 million in new capital. TeamWorks, founded more than a decade ago by then-Duke offensive lineman Zach Morides, plans to use the cash for growth. He says the company, which already has more than 80 employees, is planning to hire 60 people this year. It is also adding an additional 7,000 square feet of space at a building adjacent to its downtown Durham headquarters. TeamWorks, which offers a communication platform to organize and streamline sports events, is also exploring new sports segments, the makings of a literal dream come true for the Durham entrepreneur. As a nerdy offensive lineman, to get to spend the rest of my life building amazing, incredible technology tools and working with the top athletic organizations in the world, I don't know why anyone would want to be anywhere else, Morides says. With the new cash, the firm will also be investing in its technology to ensure it can support a bigger customer list, he says. General Catalyst Partners of Cambridge, Massachusetts led the round. 8 existing investors contributed to the raise as well, from Seaport Capital to DUMAC, Duke University's own fund. The latest funder follows a $6.3 million equity raise from 8 investors disclosed in 2016. Silicon Valley firm has big plans for Raleigh growth. A Silicon Valley startup is setting up shop in Raleigh with plans to grow its staff to triple digits by the end of the year. This office will become pretty huge in no time, says Mohit Aaron, CEO and founder of Cohesity. By the end of this year, we may have 100 people or more just at this office. Aaron says Raleigh was the obvious choice for the hyper-converged software firm and that no other metros were even considered for its East Coast hub. It's such a good pool of talent. It's just such a pool of talent available here, he says, pointing to the presence of firms such as NetApp and Cisco. You know how tech people are. They tend to collect in some pockets, and RTP is a very flourishing pocket. It is great to be where the technical talent is. Avangrid accelerates plans for offshore wind farm. Plans for a massive wind farm off the North Carolina coast are moving faster than I think anybody anticipated, says Avangrid Renewable CEO Laura Bean. Bean, whose firm won preliminary leasing rights for 122,000 acres off the coast of Kitty Hawk last year, says the project could be online as early as 2025. A lot of it just has to do with the market conditions coming together that make it very competitive, she says, noting that improvements in both process and technology, including bigger turbines being developed, are making the numbers work in offshore's favor. Costs are coming down. We have Europe to thank for that. They've paved the ground for that in offshore. In a competitive auction in March, Avangrid Renewables won the rights to develop more than 122,000 acres off the coast of North Carolina. And now we turn to the pages written by Jennifer Henderson on life sciences. Aerie changes HQ to Durham. Because of Durham's importance to Duke University spin-out Aerie Pharmaceuticals, the company has named the city its headquarters. Aerie's facility in Durham is the company's largest in the U.S. with more than 45,000 square feet, upward of 50 employees, and a unique mix of laboratory and office space at a ratio of about 60% to 40%. We have a number of positions that we'll be hiring for this year, says Casey Kobzinski, co-founder and chief scientific officer of Aerie. Since the company's start in 2005, Aerie's focus has been to bring new products to market that can treat unmet needs in patients, Kobzinski says. Aerie has additional U.S. locations in Bedminster, New Jersey, and Irvine, California, which it previously called its principal office. Aerie also invested in a manufacturing facility in Ireland. Durham's headcount is just slightly larger than Irvine and larger than Bedminster by at least 10 employees, according to Tad Heitman, head of communications at the company. We continue to add personnel in all three offices, the most significant growth, of course, being field-based as we hire a 100-person U.S. sales force, Heitman says. That sales force is being built out in advance of a mid-second quarter commercial launch of the company's first U.S. Food and Drug Administration-approved glaucoma product, Ropressa, with Aerie expecting to submit a new drug application to the FDA for another glaucoma product, Rocklatin, in the second quarter. The same sales force hired for Ropressa is expected to be sufficient to handle Rocklatin if approved as well. Heat Biologics makes move to ward off suitors. Durham's Heat Biologics disclosed March 12 that its board of directors has unanimously adopted a stockholder rights plan, otherwise known as a poison pill provision, for protection against hostile takeovers. Rights will be triggered by a 20% or more ownership of the company's outstanding common stock prior to March of next year. The timing of the plan closely follows the company's announcement late last month of positive interim data from an ongoing Phase 2 clinical trial. The trial is for its product candidate, HS110, in combination with Bristol Myers Squibb's anti-PD-1 checkpoint inhibitor, nivolumab, spelled N-I-V-O-L-U-M-A-B, in non-small cell lung cancer. Since the presentation of the data, Chairman and CEO Jeff Wolf says, "There has been substantial interest in the company," while declining to comment on the specifics of that interest and where it may be coming from. The board wanted to put this plan in place so that we can help ensure, in case there is any interest, that shareholders get adequate value for their shares, particularly with the company's currently low stock price and market capitalization, he says. Wolf adds that there were a number of groups following Heat and waiting for these results, and that there is a tremendous value there for any company in the checkpoint inhibitor space. Late last year, Heat outlined a new strategy focusing on combination therapies for the treatment of cancer. Wolf says the interim data showed just that, essentially helping to increase the effectiveness of checkpoint inhibitors on those patients least likely to respond. As of the beginning of this month, Heat's largest stockholder was Savvy Management, with a 5.5% stake. G1 nets $108 million from public offering, looks to grow in 2018. Research Triangle-based G1 Therapeutics has netted roughly $108 million from a public offering of the company's common stock on the heels of a big data readout. And the company will be looking to more milestones and growth in the remainder of 2018, according to CEO Dr. Mark Velleca. Proceeds of the company's offering will go into advancing all three programs, Trilaciclib, G1T38, and G1T38, says Velleca, and will allow us to achieve all of our planned milestones this year with cash runway into 2020. G1 recently announced good news from a Phase 2A trial of Trilaciclib in patients undergoing chemotherapy treatment for small cell lung cancer. The data showed clear evidence that Trilaciclib preserved bone marrow and immune system function from the damaging effects of chemotherapy, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Raj Malik said in a statement. People appreciate where that drug is moving and will need additional capital to move it forward, notes Velleca of the timing of the company's public offering. Additionally, Trilaciclib is currently in four Phase 2 trials, notes Velleca, with two other Phase 2 trials reading out in the fourth quarter. G1's headcount is currently at about 50 employees, according to Velleca. As the company continues to advance its trio of programs, that headcount is expected to grow by between 20 and 30 employees by the end of 2018. Hiring will be primarily in the area of clinical development and also will likely include a head of commercial for the company, he says. We'll be talking with regulators this year about the data we disclosed last week, Velleca says. A new drug application submission to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration could potentially be filed in 2021. Developers buy North Hills land for senior community. Raleigh-based Navian Senior Solutions and Northview Partners have paid roughly $3.9 million for a more than 8-acre parcel of land along St. Albans Drive for another development. The new project is for a 189-unit senior living community, the Reserve at North Hills. The partners recently closed on a $40 million financing for the development of a 152-unit senior living community in Apex. Construction on the North Hills project is slated to start this spring, says Navian Vice President of Corporate Strategy Eric Morton. With an expected opening in 2020, that's about 4 to 5 months behind the senior living community planned in Apex, the Reserve at Mills Farm. The five-story project includes independent living, assisted living, and memory care, as well as amenities such as a movie theater, gourmet cafe bistro, indoor aquatic center, and nearby greenway. It will employ about 100 permanent employees, Morton says. One of the unique aspects of the project, notes Morton, is the integration into the broader North Hills master plan. It's situated across the way from more than 50 acres owned by developers Kane Realty and DeWitt Carolinas. On Real Estate, written by Ben Graham. Baker Roofing moving to new Garner home. The new owner of an old Kmart-anchored shopping center in Garner, just across the Raleigh border, has plans to revamp the property with extensive renovations and new construction. Baker Roofing, a company with a long history in Raleigh and a reach across the South, purchased the 29-acre site at 4300 Fayetteville Road, currently home to a Sears, for $8.6 million. But that investment is just the beginning, says Prentice Baker III, Baker Roofing chairman. With residential and commercial business continuing to ramp up, the firm has been on the hunt for a new Raleigh office. The company has been at 517 Mercury Street since 1972. We've outgrown our facilities and space over here, Baker says. Parking is a huge problem for us. But significant work is required at the shopping center to prep it for the roofing company. The property lacks a shop yard. The building also needs a new roof, something that Baker knows a bit about. Renovations to the exterior of the building will be at least a year-long process, he says. We've got a lot of work to do to the building inside and out, Baker says. In the meantime, he says the firm is in talks with a national company about developing more square footage on 3 acres of the property's street frontage along Fayetteville Road. More changes could be in the works for the property, Baker says. We've got a big, spacious area there, and we have a lot of potential and possibilities, he says. The company's existing location is near downtown Raleigh. Baker says there are no plans to sell the property. Kmart announced it was closing the Garner location in 2013. The old shell, now filled partly by Sears, consists of 170,740 square feet and is 77% leased. Baker Roofing purchased it from Soad Properties, LLC, an entity managed by Isa Sheikh. Sheikh owns several commercial and residential properties throughout southern Wake County. Baker Roofing provides a variety of roofing services. Based on total revenue, Baker Roofing is the third largest roofing contractor in the country, according to the International Roofing Expo. Older mixed-use office park gets overhaul. The new owner of Regency Office Park in Cary has wasted little time in revamping the complex. The park is one of the Triangle's oldest mixed-use developments, and Alladade Capital, which purchased it in October, is planning extensive renovations. The firm intends to revamp two of the park's five buildings inside and out. A virtual tour on the park's website shows sleek new lobbies with abstract paintings hanging on the wall and a social hub with lounge furniture and a glass window looking out onto a leafy portion of the park. Interior upgrades also include new cafes, flexible meeting spaces, and conference centers. Gyms and private showers are in the works as well. Both buildings will get an exterior facelift, including new entryways and color schemes. The office park opened in 1984 with a 114,876 square foot building. The building at 2000 Regency Parkway, one of the two being renovated, was opened 3 years later. Alladade, based in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, has several investments in the Triangle. Cary School buys 48 acres in Morrisville for expansion. A small Cary private school with big ambitions has purchased 48 acres in Morrisville. Hopewell Academy plans a relocation and expansion on the site on Comstock Road across the Durham County line. An entity managed by banker Joseph Zhao purchased the land for $5.4 million. Zhao says he worked as a consultant to facilitate the deal. Hopewell Academy currently operates out of a 13,400-square-foot building off Cary Parkway. Tuition for high schoolers costs $9,500. For international students, the rate jumps to $24,000 and includes supplemental English language instruction. Principal Kenneth Branch directed questions to its board of directors, who mostly live in China. Dr. Lisa Wang, board chair, didn't respond to an email for comment. First new tenant moving into GSK's former RTP space. The freshly renovated Venture Center in Research Triangle Park has fire pits, hammocks, outdoor ping pong tables, and its first tenant. Renesas Electronics Marika, a semiconductor company, is moving into 40,000 square feet of Class A office space in the building, which Longfellow Real Estate Partners acquired from GlaxoSmithKline in 2016. At the time, the 142,726 square foot building was vacant, but a $21.9 million loan funded extensive improvements. For Longfellow, the transformation of the Venture Center is representative of larger trends in office space market. We had a building pretty much stuck in the 1990s that we completely gutted and rebuilt to meet the needs of 21st century businesses like Renesas. Longfellow Director of Leasing Neil Sharon said, "What we have now is representative of the change we're seeing from a decades-old view of office space as strictly functionary to a space designed with amenities that inspire creativity and spark collaboration." Upgraded Durham apartments sell for $27 million. An Austin, Texas real estate investment firm has renovated and sold two Durham apartment communities for an $8.5 million gain and says it foresees more investment in the Triangle ahead. Artesia Real Estate purchased the Oaks at Northgate and Leon Court in 2016 for $17.5 million, according to Durham County records. The complexes are within 2 miles of downtown, but were built decades ago and needed upkeep, the firm says. Over the past 2 years, Artesia pumped $1 million into the developments, fixing roofs, painting the exterior, and upgrading the clubhouses and common areas. With the work complete, the company sold both complexes for $27 million to Cedar Grove Capital of Woodmere, New York. The sale of Oaks at Northgate and Leon Court is a tremendous success for our firm, and we are confident that the asset is primed for the new owners to roll out their business plan, Artesia principal Colin Brothers stated. And now we turn to the executive voice that focuses on David Ellis. His age is 50, family, dogs, Bo and Billy, education, BS, psychology, James Madison University, MPA, public administration, George Mason University, first job, busboy at Mr. Gaddy's Pizza in Fredericksburg, Virginia. The headline on this Q&A column, written by Lauren K. Onasorge, interim title gone, he's now in charge of Wake County. New Wake County manager David Ellis is hardly new in town. Ellis had been a deputy manager for the county since 2015 and interim county manager since the departure of Jim Hartman last year. Ellis was nonetheless overjoyed to remove the interim title and get to work. Ellis, a native of Fredericksburg, Virginia, has lofty goals for his office, perhaps the biggest one, to improve communication. Ellis enters the position months after an audit focused on the Wake County Register of Deeds office found more than $2 million unaccounted for, more than $2 million unaccounted for transactions, and former Wake County Register of Deeds Laura Riddick was charged with embezzlement. Ellis says the situation taught him the importance of communication, a lesson he'll deploy when working with Wake County's Board of Commissioners and Board of Education. Here, Ellis talks about the challenges he expects to take on with the job and his secret soap opera obsession. What's one of the biggest challenges you faced thus far in your career, and how did you solve it? One thing most folks are not aware of is that local governments are extremely diverse and complex as they relate to responsibilities of staff and the elected bodies. As an example, in some localities, the chief administrative officer is an elected position, and in others, the elected body appoints an individual to fulfill that role. In transitioning from Virginia to North Carolina, I've had to get up to speed on the subtle differences fairly quickly. I did that by learning from current and past staff, community members, school representatives, and nonprofit staff, and by asking a lot of questions. What's your proudest moment in government? Being selected as the Wake County manager. What's your personal motto? Achievement in every field of human endeavor. What are the top three challenges facing Wake County in the next 5 years? Planning for continued population growth now and in the future, addressing housing affordability, and maintaining and improving the quality of life here in Wake County. What apps are on your phone? Facebook, Babbel, LinkedIn, Twitter, The Washington Post, HomeAway, Netflix, Hulu, and Wegmans, to name a few. When you were 8 years old, what did you want to be when you grew up? A football player for the Washington Redskins. Do you have any mentors? I have had numerous mentors, including my father, Richard Serbay, Bob Stalzer, Verdia Haywood, Bob O'Neill, Jim Hartman, Stan Belcher, Anthony Griffin, Pam Antill, and Ken Chandler, among others. What's the best business advice you've ever received and who delivered it? You have two ears and one mouth for a reason, my father. Where's your favorite place for a business lunch? Capital Club 16 and a place at the table. What's your go-to vacation spot? Isla Mujeres, Mexico. What's something that might surprise people about David Ellis? That I'm a diehard fan of Days of Our Lives. If you weren't involved in county government, what career do you think you'd have? A teacher or coach? How would you describe your management style? Collaborative. What would you tell a CEO considering relocating a business to the Triangle? This area offers everything for your company to be successful. A wealth of talent, people focused on lifelong learning, a strong arts and music community, and a quality of life second to none. And now we turn to general news in the Triangle Business Journal. How a small sushi firm got big North Carolina incentives, written by Lauren K. Onasorge. How does a tiny company sell its project to the state for nearly $2 million in incentives? by enlisting a big backer. That's what happened with Rice Wrap Foods, a.k.a. Project Smashdown, a tiny two-employee operation promising to bring 305 jobs to Granville County. The Raleigh startup, made up of just the father and son team of Richard and Kyle Kronk, finagled an incentives package worth up to $1.9 million in job development investment grant reimbursements over 12 years. Nearly 300 pages of public records show they didn't do it alone. It came down to Bumblebee Seafood's $12 million strategic investment, which is funding virtually all of the initial costs of setting up Rice Wrap's new food processing plant. No payments will be made until the entire capital being provided by Bumblebee Corporation is deposited and confirmed, the state writes. Rice Wrap teamed with former North Carolina Commerce Secretary John Scavarla, now a consultant with Nexen Pruitt, to sell the project to the state in late 2017. Because of the startup nature of the project, Susan Fleetwood, Executive Director of Economic Development at the North Carolina Department of Commerce, sent Rice Wrap finance data to Scott Dougherty, State Director of the Small Business and Technology Development Center, on December 18 for feedback. The key factor supporting the success of this venture is the relationship of the company with a major brand-named food company, Dougherty responded December 19. In the meantime, Rice Wrap accelerated that partnership with Bumblebee. According to a memo from Laura Johnson Lee, a food processing business recruitment manager with the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, Bumblebee approved the term sheet December 15 and 3 days later was wiring $625,000. This is an enormous statement of faith by Bumblebee in this project and Project Smashdown, Lee wrote. A JDIG was approved in closed session at the North Carolina Economic Investment Committee on January 23. A description of the final terms of the agreement was delivered February 13. It included major contingencies. The grant scheduled to start in 2019 required that Rice Wrap maintain a minimum of 275 jobs to secure state funds. In addition to Bumblebee Foods' investment, the firm would have to demonstrate that it had met certain net income standards. In 2019, it would be required to demonstrate a net income of at least $6.8 million and an EBITDA of at least $9.7 million. For 2020, the firm would have to demonstrate net income of $13.3 million and an EBITDA of $18.4 million to be eligible for state grants. Rice Wrap predicts revenue of more than $9 million in year one, rising to more than $81 million in year three, records show. With $75 million, this Durham company hopes to get closer to product. Ahead of moving into a new headquarters in Durham and potential U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval, Humacyte, developing human tissue products for use in regenerative medicine and vascular surgery, has raised $75 million in a Series C preferred stock financing. The financing is led by a consortium of existing investors and new investors, including Point State Capital. Humacyte says and brings the company's total funding to more than $330 million, upward of $290 million in private investments, and up to $40 million in federal and state awards. Funds from the latest financing are slated to be used for an ongoing Phase 3 trial of its bioengineered blood vessel, known as Humacyl, in patients with end-stage renal disease, according to the company. The product has the potential to become part of a person's living tissue as well as last longer and produce fewer complications than synthetic vessels. Additionally, funds will be used to complete the development and qualification of the planned manufacturing system for Humacyl, according to the company. Humacyte completed enrollment of its last patients for a total of more than 350 in its ongoing Phase 3 trial for Humacyl in September of last year. Required to follow those patients for 12 months, Humacyte is anticipating FDA approval next year. And that article was written by Jennifer Henderson. And in our remaining minutes with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read some news from around the state. Bank of America CEO Moynihan sees big pay increase in 2017 by Greg Ryan. Bank of America Corporation Chairman and CEO Brian Moynihan earned total compensation last year valued at $21.8 million, a 37% increase over 2016, and also realized $18 million in value from the vesting of previously issued stock awards from past years. Moynihan's $21.8 million in new compensation earned in 2017 included salary, new equity awards, and other perks, as well as the change in value of his pension and certain other deferred compensation earnings, according to the company's proxy filing. Moynihan's pay rose mostly because Bank of America handed him higher stock awards based on the company's performance. Its pre-tax earnings were up significantly last year. In the proxy, the bank pointed to an increase in mobile users and upgraded long-term debt ratings as among Moynihan's accomplishments in 2017. His 2017 stock awards, none of which are yet vested, totaled $19.5 million last year, compared with $13.8 million in 2016. Last year's stock awards are the highest Moynihan has received since he became CEO in 2010. Looking at only Moynihan's salary, past stock awards that vested, and other perks like use of a corporate aircraft, in other words, compensation that was available to him in 2017, not including incentives, Moynihan took home $19.8 million last year. That figure does not include the change in value of his pension and certain other deferred compensation earnings. Moynihan does not receive an annual cash bonus. Moynihan, 58, was a key executive at Fleet Boston, once the largest bank headquartered in Boston, before that company was acquired by Bank of America in 2004. He has continued to live in Wellesley rather than move to Charlotte. Moynihan's compensation last year included $205,084 for the use of corporate aircraft. The $205,084 figure includes elements of business travel, as well as all personal flights taken for non-business purposes, the filing said. And as we're down to our last seconds, we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.